Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Denny Rancourt. Denny has a very important, let's put it this way. Denny has waged a four-year battle to reinstate himself after he was summarily and unjustifiably, Denny, how would I put it?
Dismissed? Fired?
Fired from the University of Ottawa, ousted from the University of Ottawa unjustly, certainly not for anything that would warrant that kind of treatment, for absolutely malicious reasons. And the president of the University of Ottawa, Alan Rock, a former Canadian politician, you know, the typical type of political hack who does this kind of stuff. Denny, let me just explain to listeners who may not know you. I think regulars do, but the ones who don't, you're a distinguished tenured professor. You're an expert in your field, I think two fields, environmental science and physics. You're the kind of person who gets high honors and praise, not the kind of person who gets treated the way you have been. We want to discuss the four-year battle that you wage, an extraordinary battle, Denny. You're not a lawyer, my God. I mean, you're a physics expert. You're an environmental science expert. You're not a legal expert, and yet you've done this heroic job on your own, and at least the thing that you mentioned to me, that part of it has not had a happy ending, and I think your troubles still go on. But we're going to begin the program discussing that. And then two other topics I want to discuss. The Sochi Olympics began on Thursday. I have no interest in the competition. I couldn't name a single competitor or who's winning what for what reason. That's not the issue that I want to discuss. I want to discuss the geopolitics of Sochi. And I have an article that I put out this morning. I called it Cold War Politics in Sochi. I think that pretty much explains what I'm getting into. Ugly, ugly stuff. You can expect this. We'll get into that in the program. And the third article, the third topic I'd like to discuss is at the end of January, Ben Bernanke ended a 10-year reign at the Federal Reserve. He stepped down. Janet Yellen replaced him. I wrote a couple of times about Yellen. I don't expect much of anything changing on her watch. The Fed is owned and operated by Wall Street, so you know the way that dirty game goes. But I want to talk about the Bernanke legacy a little bit and also the kind of stuff that will continue at the Federal Reserve. The fact that he stepped down is good time to do it. Denny, let me let you take over and explain the latest that you passed on to me during the week. I must say it had my stomach in an uproar for a while, and just thinking about it now, it's back in an uproar again.
Yes, well, first I want to just clarify that my union did support me in this recent battle that we're talking about. I mean, there are two large litigations that I'm involved with. One was contest my dismissal, which occurred in 2009. The other big legal battle is a private defamation lawsuit that's being waged against me, where the University of Ottawa, my former employer, is funding that litigation against me. Okay, so those are two separate things. And I'm self-represented in the defamation lawsuit, and that's where I've had to really become as much of a lawyer as I can. And presently that, there's an element of that lawsuit that's before the Supreme Court of Canada. So that's one battle, but the most recent news is regarding the decision with regards to my grievance to contest my dismissal, which occurred in 2009. So it's taken almost 5 years to get this decision. It's been a lot of work, but in that battle, my union has supported me, and in fact, it was union lawyers that were making the arguments on my behalf, or not on my behalf, but on behalf of the union. I was merely in that a witness, but of course, the person who suffered the consequences. But so I was not leading the actual legal arguments or the legal charge, so I just wanted to clarify that, okay?
Denny, I think we've discussed on the program before, I think a major factor in why you were dismissed, they talked about your pedagogic situation, your grading system and so on, but I think that probably was largely a smokescreen. The fact that you so forthrightly have supported Palestinian rights, that I think was a major contributing factor. And who knows, when they want to get you, Denny, they can make up any reasons they want and then go after you. And just like the so-called war on terror, I like to point out all the time, that the only terror threats America and Canada have are the ones that they invent. I don't look under my bed to see if there are any terrorists there before I go to bed at night. And I can't think of a single terrorist attack on American soil in my entire lifetime, and that includes 9/11.
Well, they actually argued in the labor arbitration in the case that I just lost. They actually argued in a sense that I was a terrorist. They didn't use that word, but they basically said that I incite students to violence. And they said all kinds of horrible things about me, none of which, happily, I'm happy to report, none of which the arbitrator or the judge, if you like, retained. He didn't retain any of that garbage that the university was putting forward. There's no mention of it, even though they spent days and days trying to make that case that I was this monster of a person and so on. But that's a separate question. If you want to talk about terrorism, we can. But
well, I want to talk about your situation.
Yeah, yeah.
let me just very briefly mention one thing, because I'm writing about this, and I don't know whether I'll get it out tomorrow. I'll certainly get it out next week, maybe if not Sunday, then Monday or Tuesday. There's a new bill circulating in the House of Representatives, Denny. It's called the Protect Academic Freedom Act. It relates to the two organizations, academic organizations in America, who have taken aim at Israeli academic institutions. It's a way of targeting Israel for the crimes it commits against Palestinians. The organizations do not target Israeli academics, and they're not targeting Israel directly, but they're targeting institutions. And
I wrote about the reasons why they should. An academic boycott,
exactly.
Yeah. I wouldn't call that targeting. I mean, I think that's just a political leverage to make a point and to apply pressure with regards to human rights in Israel. But
the law, Denny, that's circulating in the House, it's only gone into committee, which is step one, and the committee hasn't even discussed it yet. It hasn't been introduced in the Senate. But the idea is to cut off funding for any organization like this or any university that dares take on Israel in any way, and do the kind of things that that these two organizations have done responsibly. It's completely unconstitutional.
Well, boycott is the last ultimate freedom that we have as citizens and as members of associations. It's the last thing that we can do. In a nonviolent democratic society, you can express your opinion and you can boycott. And so, how can they take away boycott and make it illegal? That's crazy.
It really is crazy. It's a direct violation of the First Amendment, and Canada has a law very comparable to the First Amendment. So really, it's been so long since I wrote about Canadian law. The Canadian, what is it called again?
The Charter?
The Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Oh, it's been a few years, but I remember quoting directly from that on laws relating to our First Amendment and so on. The two organizations in America, the first one did it, I think it was last April, Association for Asian American Studies, and the American Studies Association was the most recent one.
Yeah.
And two states are going after them, and now the House of Representatives and the Israeli ambassador, former Israeli ambassador, who's now a CNN analyst.
yes, I heard about that. Now, this is so crazy, this battle. I mean, it's insane. It's insane the funds, the magnitude of the campaign against a professional association because it dared to say that its official position was to do an academic boycott of Israel for the reasons that it explained, that they mounted this counter move that is just massive with lawsuits and laws being passed. It's just crazy. What kind of a crazy country are you living in? it's insane. But yeah, I agree with you entirely. But now, coming back to my case, you said that my firing was done on the basis of a pretext, and I totally agree. This whole grading issue was a pretext. In fact, when you read the arbitrator's decision, it's very clear that I did nothing wrong. The arbitrator essentially says that. So it was a pretext, and I'll explain how he says that, my interpretation of it. But why did they want to get rid of me? Well, they never said that publicly. They're very non-direct in that regard. They're the opposite of open. But one other major reason, I think, would be my public criticisms of the institution and of its administrators on my blog, U of O Watch. That blog, I'm sure, is very disturbing to them and is probably a reason why they went after me. In fact, the defamation lawsuit concerns an article on that blog that's being done in parallel, so there's a link there. And also, during the labor arbitration, they argued at length that my blog was vicious and inappropriate, and that this is a reason why retroactively they should be firing me and not allowing me back on campus. So even though they have never disciplined me, they've never dared to say you're not allowed to say things on your blog, they've never disciplined me for my blog. I was blogging for years while I was a professor, and I was being very critical of the administration, naming them, talking about, non-ethical things they were doing, saying that so-and-so is lying, presenting evidence that there's a lie, that the president is supporting the lie, and so on. I was blogging all about this all along. They threatened to sue me once and then just totally dropped it. But they never disciplined me through the disciplinary mechanisms. And then at arbitration, years later, they decided that that was, that they wanted to use this retroactively to fire me. You know, it's just, so that shows maybe what the real reason was as opposed to the pretext for firing me. But, you know, I want to bring you back in a time capsule, Stephen, to 2009 when I was fired. And at that time, it was in the national and international media that the university was preparing to fire me and was on the verge of firing me. And there was a lot of attention. It was written about, you know, in the New York Times, in the equivalent of that national paper here in Canada. It's called the Globe and Mail. And I want to read to you a very short letter that one of the readers wrote in response to an article that had just appeared in the Globe and Mail back at about the time that I was fired in 2009.
Well, please do, Denny.
Oh, it's just remarkable. This letter, so they wrote an article explaining the conflict, and then this reader wrote this short letter that was published in the national paper, and they gave it the title Free to Learn. And it's written by a person called Julia DeBono, who turned out to be, who is the mother of one of the students in one of my courses, okay? Uh-huh. And this is what the letter says. It says, in 2006, while shadowing my daughter, then a student of the University of Ottawa, I attended one of Denis Doncourt's classes. And this was in relation to a February 6 article in the Globe and Mail. And then she goes on to say, Professor Doncourt, clearly a dedicated, principled teacher, moderated a spirited, engaging, intellectually provocative discussion in which about 50 students eagerly participated. Other undergraduate classes that I attended consisted of the professor lecturing while students chatted, surfed the net, or took verbatim notes. Few asked questions, and there were no discussions, even when the professor asked for some. Professor Doncourt's class resembled classes I had at the University of Michigan's residential college in the mid-1970s, right down to the use of narrative summaries instead of grades to evaluate learning. His class was an example of the kind of educational experience I sent my daughter to university to be part of. End of letter.
That really is marvelous, Denny, and very sadly, there are very few professors in classrooms like yours. There are wonderful people around, but there are so many others who don't do it the way you do it.
You know, that letter was one that was published in the national paper, but there were hundreds of letters like this sent to me and made public.
Uh-huh.
And there was a petition that opposed my firing that had well over 1,000 names and various comments and so on, but none of this mattered. This material was not even put into evidence, and the university didn't care about this reality of what my work was and what I was doing. And it decided to use this pretext of grading in order to dismiss me, and one of the things it used in that argument to dismiss me was this idea that because I was giving talks about my ideas and my ideology about teaching and grading, and because those talks were radical and I was explaining how you know, it would be better to get rid of grades and the rank ordering of students and so on. They actually hired a student to spy on me to go and collect those talks and then to report back to the university. And then they used that material, those talks, the reports written by the student spy, as evidence against me in this arbitration, even though it was collected by spying, even though this kind of spying is antithetical to academic freedom. It's a violation of freedom of thought and expression. It's a horrible thing to do to a professor. They had a duty, if they were investigating me under the contract with professors, they had a duty to inform me that they were investigating me and the methods they were using to investigate me. They never did. And despite that, the arbitrator went ahead and used that material without any moderation of it in the light of how it had been collected and for what purpose and under what circumstances. He refused to look at that. So the arbitrator refused to look at all the evidence that the union presented of the university's bad faith. Just blanketly said it was not relevant, which I find, you know, is pretty frightening for that to occur in an arbitration. But what the arbitrator found was that, and this is how he upheld the dismissal. He basically said that a student-centered teaching method, which is what I was using and what I explained I was using, and I was very open about it, and I explained it to my dean and to everybody else. He said that that kind of a method, based on where the student is at, what the needs of the students are, and adapting the teaching to the individual students and evaluating them individually, is inconsistent with my contract as a university professor, because my contract says that I must evaluate students objectively. All right? So he was arguing that if it's student-centered, it can't possibly be objective, according to him, by definition of objective, which in my opinion is complete nonsense, but that's how it was decided. And then the arbitrator said, it may well be, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, it may well be that this student-centered approach is better in terms of learning physics. And, you know, there have been books written about it, he said, but the university has a right, he said, to insist that a grading method that pits one student against the other, he used that expression, one student against the other, to insist that that be applied. And therefore, this is so egregious that the Professor Dancourt used these methods, even though he doesn't, you know, he admits that I was authentically trying to use that method and I was open about it. He said it's so egregious that it amounts to a form of academic fraud. How it can be fraud is beyond me. I was completely open about it. I was doing it on the basis of research for the good of the students, and it, in my view, was compatible with my duties under the collective agreement, you know, with the contract. It was compatible with the language of the contract, and he found that what I did was a form of academic fraud.
What comes next in your effort to get reinstated? Is it a dead end?
I don't know yet, because I still have to. I have a discussion this week with the union lawyers and with, and I may consult others and so on. But we're still deciding legally how to approach this, and so that's not something I can comment on at the moment. But as it stands, that ruling is against academic freedom and has very negative consequences for all professors in Canada.
To my
mind, it should not be allowed to stand.
It absolutely shouldn't be allowed to stand. Unfortunately, it happens in America all too often. Joel Covell, Bard College, he wrote an important book called Overcoming Zionism, I believe the name was, and one of the quotes from the book, one of the quotes that I've used several times in my articles, he called Israel, quote, a machine for the manufacture of human rights abuses. What an accurate statement. That really sums it up so well. Norman Finkelstein in Chicago, DePaul University, same thing. Ward Churchill, not anything to do with Israel, but Ward Churchill fired from the University of Colorado. There's an academic in California whose name escapes me, I think again on the Israel issue, I think dismissed from one of the West Coast universities. And I'm sure there have been others, Denny. So, you know,
yeah.
You take a stand for what's right and you get yourself in big trouble. And you go up against the system. They have deep pockets. It's a very, very tough struggle.
But as a consequence, I mean, granted, there were reasons, real reasons, which they didn't tell us for dismissing me in this way and for attacking me constantly in this way. I mean, the horrendous battle that I had to, be subjected to over years and years before they finally dismissed me, There was reason behind that, in the sense they were motivated by the fact that I was a very critical and independent-minded individual, and that I kept pointing out their misfeasance and their errors as I saw them, and truthfully, and that I opposed the doctrine that one cannot criticize Israel, and I invited Palestinian activists into my classrooms to talk and so on. All that is part of it, and they attempted one time to discipline me for who I had invited in my classroom, and that just flopped, and they had to retract it because of how I managed to divert, to defend myself against that.
Denny, what you did is what academia should be all about in every classroom all the time. I mean, the whole idea of going to school at any level is to learn. You know, you teach as a teacher, but students come to learn, and if they don't learn, then what's the point of teaching? And it's important to learn truths and vital stuff. And I never took a course in physics. I know nothing about it, but I'm certain if I attended one of your classes enough times, I'd have learned to love physics, and yet I can't say anything about it because I know nothing about it. But I'm certain I would have loved it because of your approach. I only had a couple of professors that came close to what you did, Denny. It was a real shame, and had a lot of distinguished people who taught classes I attended, but they didn't teach as well as a couple in my mind, and they were absolutely marvelous. And if everybody taught like them and like you, what a wonderful experience academia would be.
Well, the university dared, in addition to dismissing me, which they wanted to do all along, they dared to discipline me because I wasn't, according to them, following the course curriculum in my courses. And they did that. They disciplined me for that twice. The first one was a separate arbitration that I entirely won on that point. The arbitrator said everything he did in his classes was under the purview of academic freedom, inviting activists in the classroom to motivate the science learning. All that is allowed. And gave me reason on those points. And despite that, they disciplined me again for the same thing in a very similar course, and that discipline was part of the dismissal discipline. He considered at the same time. Well, the arbitrator had the sense in that one, since there was absolutely no evidence that I hadn't covered the material in the course, I won that one. So they had to completely refrain from ever mentioning that again and saying that I hadn't covered the course material in a course. So they never were able to argue that I didn't actually teach. They never were able to argue, they had no evidence to say that I didn't give homework, a test, a final exam, all of which I did. There was hard evidence of all of that, copies of a grading sheet, copies of exams, and despite that, when the university dismissed me, they said that I didn't grade at all, that I had simply assigned fraudulent grades out of the blue without any relationship to academic performance.
Anyone, they want to get you or anybody else, they can do anything they want. They can invent any reasons. They
well,
don't have to be
the
true.
Shocking thing is that the arbitrator, went along with this crazy notion. And in the face of physical evidence, in the face of testimony, in the face of the counter witnesses admitting that it's possible that, yeah, I did those things, and so on. You know, their main witness, the dean, admitted that they had no evidence whatsoever, not an iota of evidence that any one student didn't deserve the grade that I assigned to them.
Denny,
despite all that, the arbitrator finds that this is academic fraud.
awful. Denny, I want to move on to the next topic.
I may let you, do you want me to stay and hash it out with you?
Or? Absolutely. I value your comments on everything. To me, the bottom line of what you've gone through and what other people like you have gone through is a fundamental injustice in Canada, in America, in Western societies, where if you go up against the system honorably, if you go against the things that they stand for that can be lawless and dishonorable, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble. And as they used to say in Boston, where I grew up, you know, go fight City Hall. Good luck to you. It's a lot tougher when you go up against a state or even a university. Denny, let's move on.
My legal battles are continuing big time. I'm totally out of money. They have got cost orders against me through that big defamation case of about $250,000 up to now. And we haven't even gone to trial yet. I'm preparing for trial. And just preparing for trial, just getting the documents ready and everything costs money. So I want to appeal to your listeners again. There is a defense fund, a legal defense fund, to support me. If anyone wants to give any amount, it would be great. All they need to do is go to one of my blogs, and there is a PayPal button there, and they can donate. For example, you could go to the U of O Watch blog, which is the same blog that got me into so much trouble, or you can go to the Activist Teacher blog. Both of these are on blogspot.com, and they both have the pay button options there on the front page. I'd really appreciate any kind of help that your listeners can provide in that regard.
Denny, you certainly deserve it. And if they forget the names of your blog, they can simply Google your name and your blog sites will come up automatically, because that's the way I've accessed them a number of times.
Yeah.
And your name is certainly in the PRN archives if they forget how to spell it. The way I access my blog is I simply Google my last name. I go there every day to post articles.
Right.
If I want to check something, it really is a simple way to
do
it.
Well, my name is easy to spell, because it's like Dennis, but with one N,
with
because
one
it's an E, and then Rancourt is Rancourt, and Google that, and you'll get lots of stuff about me, the wiki page, and of course my blogs, U of O Watch and Activist Teacher.
I hope people don't mess up your name the way they mess up my name. a simple name
but
like mine.
I'd really appreciate that support. Your listeners have been very generous in the past, and this is a special. I need to put a push on now, because I'm headed to trial, and it's going to be months of preparation for me. The trial is in May, and there's probably other legal steps regarding this dismissal as well. So I really could use some financial support just to help me. I'm not going to pay lawyers with it. I'm only paying court fees and things to keep me going. I'm allowed to defend myself. They can't take that away from me, even if I have no money. But I do need a little bit of money just to be able to file the documents and get court transcripts and things like that, which ends up costing quite a lot of money.
And Denny, I've told you before, and I'll say it again, as long as I have a radio program and a voice on air, you are absolutely welcome as an honored guest anytime to support your cause, because it's a cause, bottom line again, Denny, a cause for justice, and I can't think of too much that's any more important than that. Let's move on to Sochi.
Okay.
The Olympics began on Thursday. I didn't realize that some events begin before the opening ceremonies. I don't know the procedure for these things. I won't watch 10 seconds of the events. I'm simply not interested in them. And there's another side to the Olympics that I don't appreciate at all, and I've written about that, two, 3 years ago, I think around the time of the London Olympics, 2012. So I'm not a big Olympics fan. I don't care about the exploitation of athletes and the money involved and so on, but I very much care about the geopolitics. The security in Russia is absolutely beyond imagination, Denny. There is a real fear, and I agree with them, there's a real fear of a possible terrorist attack, or
yes,
maybe more than one, and $2 billion was spent on security. 23,000 personnel were involved getting things set in place ahead of time. Tens of thousands of police are on duty. Russia is using helicopters, drones, gunboats, submarines, 70,000 Russian troops to protect security. All of the venues are extremely heavily guarded. Well, there is a threat of an Islamic jihadist targeting of the event. Well, dear I say, and I mentioned this in my article that I got out this morning, these people are U.S. assets. They began, at least back in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden, a U.S. invention, fighting the Soviets back in those days. America uses these individuals, did so in Libya. They're being used in Syria. America uses them wherever they want to use them.
Yeah, well, they'll use anyone that they feel there's a benefit from using, and then they'll drop them when they think they can drop them without serious negative consequences, and or if they're not useful anymore, it's incredible the way they use people and entire communities and populations, and they're very, very disrespectful. Yes.
Oh, they are, and they actually can use a group like Al Qaeda as both enemy and ally at
sure.
the same time, Denny.
Sure.
So in Libya could be an ally, in Iraq right now could be an enemy. They can claim there's Al Qaeda in America. I don't know if I've ever heard that, but there are threats that the terrorists are coming to America. Well, in fact, Press TV had me on this morning, a short interview, discussing that possibility. The idea is to raise fear, but the fear is legitimate in Russia, in Sochi, down around the Black Sea area. And my concern, Denny, which is what I mentioned in my article, we'll get into this after the break, but I mentioned in my article, does Obama want to rain on Putin's parade? Does he want to incite a terrorist attack? Is this planned? I don't know, but it certainly is possible. Let's pick up on that when we come back.
Okay. Tell you that your listeners have already started sending notifications, donations to PayPal. I just received by email notifications of donation, so I'm really thankful that people are doing that. It's great.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I mean, I can't name anyone, obviously, but I know who they are, and I'm very, very thankful for people doing that.
Denny, I don't know of anybody more deserving than you. I honestly say that nobody more deserving to you. I mean, I love having you on this program, and yet the thing that stands out in my mind is the terrible injustice that's been done to you, and the fact that whatever I can do to help undo that injustice is what I want to do, and the fact that I have a public voice, I think that's the most positive contribution I can make, and that we've talked about your case so often. So, and we'll do it again in the future. We absolutely have to stress this. There's got to be a justice silver lining out there somewhere, and I certainly hope that you benefit from that, Denny.
Well, the other way, if people want to read about my ideas and help support my legal fund, is that they can buy my book, which is the book about fighting racism in the context of hierarchy and so on.
And the title of that again is?
Yes, let me just get that out here. I'll give you the exact website that people can go to. The book is called Hierarchy and Free Expression in the Fight Against Racism, and the website of the book, there's also another website on the publisher's page, but the website for the book is fightagainstracismbook.wordpress.com.
That's easy.
All one word, fightagainstracismbook.wordpress.com. And they can buy it online. There's various ways. You can go to Amazon or directly to the publisher, which is the best way in terms of supporting. But that book is full of my ideas about how to make society better, what is effective activism, and also analyzing society and how it functions and in terms of our individual psychologies, versus the oppression of the establishment against us. And so it's a book about that, and I hope your listeners can enjoy it. But that's another way of supporting me is to buy that.
Oh, absolutely, Denny. There's no question that racism is alive and well. It's Jim Crow. Jim Crow in America never died, and its equivalent in other countries, Canada and so on, it certainly very much is there. Let me just throw a couple more facts out about the Olympics and let you jump into that, Denny. The last terrorist attack, in fact, the only one in my memory, was 1972 Munich, when I believe 11 members of the Israeli Olympic team were killed by an organization. I think it was called Black September. Well, that was over 40 years ago. I guess Israel then was a prime target. If anybody wanted to go at Israel, it should be much more of a prime target today. But I don't believe in targeting civilians. I don't believe in violence as a way to solve any problem. The other issue with the Sochi Olympics is Russia and Vladimir Putin. Putin and Obama, their ideologies are literally polar opposite on vital things. Obama is a warrior president. Putin absolutely supports peace initiatives. And I can't think of any two more worthy people for Nobel Peace Prizes for what they've done to keep America from bombing Syria and doing any more harm than it's already done than Vladimir Putin and his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. And I'm certain they could be nominated, but they won't win the Nobel Prize. But they certainly deserve the Nobel Prize, not war criminals like Obama and other people like them who've won the award. But the issue, as far as Sochi goes, literally is raining on Putin's parade because he's independent, he supports peace, not war, and any way that America and their allies can do to mess up his major event, which is very important for Russia, $50 billion was spent on this. It's a very important thing to keep it running smoothly. You don't want the whole thing to come apart, especially with a major terrorist attack and have athletes or attendees get killed. So it's extremely important to prevent that. And yet I'll worry throughout the whole event. I think it ends on February 23rd, whether something might happen. And I won't follow the results, Denny, but every morning, the first thing I want to hear in the news was, did they get through another day terror-free? And that's one more. But it's got a long way to go.
Yeah. I think that the security apparatus is probably tight enough to prevent anything. You know, I mean, the big states have learned how to do this, how to come down with a dome of security that is just so airtight for these big events, you know. So I would be surprised if there was any kind of, if there's anything, it'll be minor. They've learned from the past, and they know that anyone who wants to make trouble and who wants it to be known and who wants to draw attention to their cause is going to target these events. So, I don't know. I personally don't see it. As you say, it hasn't happened in a long time. The reason is the security apparatus has been developed to such a large extent. And the borders are also tighter than they ever were. With all this technology, cameras everywhere, and fancy passports that you can't fake, and so on, right? So,
yes.
It's tight. It's difficult for individuals. You know, you can't. They know where you are every step of the way. I mean, there was a murder in Montreal recently, about a couple years ago, and the person fled to Europe, and they went and picked him up in no time flat. You know, it didn't matter that he wasn't using his credit card or anything, you know. There's so many ways they can trace you and so many ways to know where you are and what you're doing anytime you log on to anything. So I would be very surprised if some group managed to do something significant. I mean, they're able to act effectively in a war zone, obviously, where they control some of the territory and they have freedom of movement and they have weapons and they're tied to various elements of the population. They can defend themselves on their own territory, but to mount a terrorist attack in a security tight nation like the U.S. or the USSR, that would be very difficult to do unless you had the kind of technology that could deliver a weapon of mass destruction at a distance or something like that, you know, which is the fiction, the Hollywood fictions that they talk about. But no one that is a terrorist group has that kind of technology that it could use without it being a suicide attack, in the sense that the retaliation would be so vicious and extreme that it would just wipe out the entire infrastructure that would be responsible for that, you know. So there's the protection of what the retaliation would be, and there's, I mean, imagine if there was any kind of a terrorist chemical attack or anything like that against Americans or allies. The barrier that presently exists for using nuclear weapons and for being extremely vicious in terms of attacking populations and entire territories, those barriers would just come right down, and the retaliations would be so tremendous. A bit like we saw in after 9/11, where, you know, it was okay to just start a war of destruction against a country that had nothing to do with the attacks, like Afghanistan and Iraq and so on. Just, you know, all that war was permitted because of there had been an attack. Now imagine if that attack wasn't just some plane, but was an actual weapon, chemical or other. The retaliations would be tremendous, and I think anyone who has any notion that they might do something like that against these powerful states must have in the back of their minds, I mean, these people are not crazy, they're not insane, they must know that the retaliation would be 10 times worse than anything they might have done, you see. So that has to play a role. And so I think there is a counterbalance, and there's, the likelihood of these attacks is small. I think the most that people can do now is defend themselves on their own territory, like Lebanon did admirably the last time that Israel tried to invade it. It was remarkable. They just stopped the Israeli tanks in their tracks with anti-tank weapons, and, you know, they're able to do that, and so it forced Israel. The only thing Israel could do was attacks from the air, which is just indiscriminate and not very strategically effective. So you can defend yourself on your territory, but I don't see terrorist attacks as a viable way of defending a people or a nation that are being attacked. I just don't see it happening against you know, such powerful enemies.
Well, Denny, I certainly hope you're right. And Russia is a very, very technologically savvy country. They've had 7 years to plan for this, and you can bet you that there's all kinds of security measures in place that neither you or I or my listeners have ever heard about. And the thousands of personnel that are involved, and no one is allowed into the potentially affected areas who are not authorized. Obviously, the athletes and the countries, personnel representing them, but all of the attendees, journalists, and everybody, they all have to have authorization to be
there.
Well,
that's the thing, and that's not technology. That's knowing how to do counterterrorism, you know. I think their knowledge of counterterrorism, because of their experience as a warring nation, is very, very high, just as it is with the U.S. and with Israel. So they know how to anticipate where the danger will come from and how to neutralize it, how to make sure that it can't get in, you know. That knowledge, I think, is very deep in these large institutionalized machines. So the individual and the small players have virtually no chance of attacking the superpowers, whether they're regional superpowers or the only global superpower. There's just no way that terrorism can be effective in terms of controlling these regional and global superpowers in their control and of the economies, in their oppression of peoples. There's no way that terrorism works now. So the only thing you can do, I think, when you're defending yourself, whether it's Palestinians or others, is appeal to morality, which I think the boycott movement is part of, or defend yourself on your own territory. You know, at least when they come in on foot or with tanks to actually push you back or whatever, you can defend yourself. And the only reason you can defend yourself is the only time you can defend yourself is against those kinds of invasions. I mean, if they decide to annihilate you with nuclear weapons, that's something you can't defend yourself against. So, and the only thing keeping them from doing that is a kind of global morality that still exists in the middle class in Europe and even in North America, that, you know, it's just not right to practice genocidal methods and eliminate all life from a territory. That's just not, it's still not acceptable. And I dread the day when that will become acceptable because, you know, humanity has been there in the past and it wouldn't take much to go back there again and to say that it's okay to in quotations, cleanse a territory with nuclear weapons because they're now have attacked us in this terrible way or whatever, you know. We're not that far from that kind of thinking. And that's, I think, what we have to dread more than anything. Because,
oh, indeed. Indeed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you know, the U.S. is just so close to crossing that barrier and saying, well, you know, we're now justified. These people are crazy, and all they want is to destroy us. You know, the kind of language that Bush was using, you know, in terms of, you know, they're against our freedoms and this kind of crap. You know, they're inhuman, basically, so we're justified in just going out and destroying whatever we want. You can take that just a little further, and all of a sudden you're using nuclear weapons and chemical weapons. I mean, the only reason the U.S. is not pro-chemical weapons is because they're easier to make. More people have access to them, so you want to be able to punish those who might use them against you, and so you make them horrific weapons that you would never dare use, and if you do, we're justified in attacking you in the extreme. That's the only reason that on their face they're against them, but in fact the U.S. has stockpiles of chemical weapons, right? And but they make like their immoral weapons to the extreme in order to protect themselves against such weapons because they know that they're more widespread. That's my understanding of
yes, indeed,
of their,
Eddie. We're beginning to creep up on the end of the program. Let's use
okay.
the rest of the program.
Yeah,
to
I'm
talk
sorry,
about...
I'm rambling a bit, but I'm giving my social theory understanding of and psychological theory of, you know, how we deal with these weapons and war.
Indeed, I wanted to use what you were saying as a segue, and really I've written about this, that there are different ways of waging wars. You can wage hot wars, you can wage political wars, you can wage economic wars or financial wars,
yes.
And short of nuclear weapons, the financial wars can be vastly more destructive. They have been vastly more destructive than the hot wars, as destructive as they have been, and I've certainly written plenty about those. But the harm that the Federal Reserve alone has done during the tenure of Alan Greenspan that ran from 1987, I believe it was August, until January 2006. I think that was the dates. And then Bernanke just finished 8 years, the end of January. I think he came in around the 1st of February of 2006. I mean, these men were financial wreckers, human wreckers of
right.
ordinary people to benefit Wall Street, to benefit the privileged people in America and around the world, and that's exactly what went on. So you literally hand trillions of dollars, trillions, multi-trillions, I've seen numbers that ran up to 23 trillion or more, either handing it to Wall Street or giving it to them interest-free to manipulate and use any way they want, and it's so many dirty aspects to the game that was played. Quantitative easing, everybody's heard about quantitative easing, and I've written how if it was used responsibly, it would work marvelously. If you put money in people's pockets, instead of dropping it on Wall Street, which is the only thing that Bernanke did, if it was dropped on Main Street, people would have money to spend. If they spent money, businesses would increase their revenues
yes,
and
but,
profits.
You know, the problem with that is the bosses would lose control. If people have money and have a way of making a living for themselves, then they become independent. They're independent thinkers. They make their own decisions. You get democracy everywhere. And that's a big problem because the powerful lose control.
Well, to a great extent, you're absolutely right, Denny. My thinking is we're old enough to remember way back when people had decent jobs. When in America, where you could get a marvelous, good-paying job. It may not be a job that a lot of people wanted to do, but marvelous to make a good living, have a car, buy a house, send your kids to college, go to work in an auto plant in Detroit, a steel mill in Pittsburgh. That stuff is all gone now.
Yes,
you've got low pay, rotten job. Just put it that way. Rotten jobs in America replacing the good ones. So the middle class is being destroyed. People don't have the money in their pockets to spend. Henry Ford was smart enough to realize if he wanted people to buy his cars, he had to pay him a decent wage. Otherwise, he couldn't sell automobiles. Of course, there wasn't globalization in those days. But at least he was a scoundrel, but he was smart enough to know that. But it's completely different now. Detroit is a ghost town.
Yeah, but it's because they've got a new paradigm. They've understood something. They understood that with that, you know, economic freedom came freedom of thought and independence of action and choice and democracy. And it gave rise to the 60s and 70s where people revolutionized the structures of their institutions and so on. Universities became more liberal and so on, all the workplaces and unionism and so on. And they realized that they could lose control and that they had largely lost some control and they needed to regain it. And the way to do it, they called it a crisis in democracy, and the way to do it was to squeeze down economically and also make gut universities so that you're not teaching thought and real knowledge, and instead you're doing obedience training and indoctrination. And so they designed it that way. They decided that you needed people that were in debt, that didn't have the kind of financial and job mobility that we had previously, and that people needed to understand that there were less possibilities, and there was a chance you weren't going to get a job. Keep them in fear, control them. This was actually planned at the highest levels. Chomsky writes about this, and others do, of course, and there have been documentary films about it. But they understood that there's a connection between economic independence and freedom and welfare, economic welfare, I mean, and democracy, and that democracy is a bad thing that you needed to control and avoid. And I think that it's not an accident. It's by design that the middle class has been decreased. It's because of this fear of losing complete control of the global economy and of the domestic economies. I think it's largely by design.
Well, Denny, you're absolutely right. And you could go back to the 1970s, you know, at the end of the 1960s era and the civil rights struggles and Martin Luther King and so on, and Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, both of them assassinated. And in the early 1970s, the Trilateral Commission, David Rockefeller, complicit with Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski, the founders of the Trilateral Commission, and if they had a motto, it would have been, there's a crisis in America, it's a crisis of democracy, too much of it. Literally, that's what was on their mind. And from that point to today, there was a plan, as you explained, to literally snuff it out and put people in the condition that they're living in today.
Yeah. And here we are trying to sort all this out. Thank God we have researchers like yourself and also people like Noam Chomsky and Norman Finkelstein and so on who get all this information through access to information, who analyze it, who try to piece it together and try to see what is the mind of the establishment and of the people who have power and who want control. How do they think? How do they operate? What do they do? How do they divide and conquer us and so on? And your work is a lot about that, too. And, you know, thank God we have those researchers because we're able as individuals then to imagine that, you know, just a little, we're able to see beyond our immediate environment where we're being oppressed by our bosses and the people at school and stuff like that. And, you know, for example, one of the big questions in the battle for justice for Palestinians is, and interpreters have gone both ways on this, you know, does America control Israel or does Israel control America?
Mm.
You know, is America using Israel as a local police in the Middle East? And It's, and America's the boss to a large extent, and they sort of tolerate the Israeli lobby just because it helps to move the population in the direction that they want to act in the Middle East using Israel, which is the thesis of Chomsky. Or is it, the other way around, that Israel has gained too much clout and too much influence on America, and America does things that are not in its interest in supporting Israel in the Middle East?
Well, there are 52 Zionist organizations in America that absolutely support Israel one-sidedly, Denny.
Yeah.
And one of my two articles that I'll put out tomorrow, I'll mention very briefly, the Anti-Defamation League, a racist organization, over 100 years old, yesterday it honored George Bush. It gave George Bush its highest award. Well, I wrote an article about it. It'll be top featured on my blog. ADL honors George Bush. If you want a review of the real Bush legacy, read my article, and you'll see what a rogue war criminal this bastard really was. And he's the only one real. Denny, many thanks. I'm going to sign off. I look forward to getting you back. Thank you,
Denny. It'll be great. All right. Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Gary Knowles' incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial